started with our program. And I'm just going to read it. Marcy Cohen Ferris is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Her research and teaching interests include the American Jewish experience and Southern foodways and culture. From 2006 to 2008, Ferris served as president of the Board of Directors of the Southern Foodways Alliance. Her first book, Matzah Ball Gumbo, Culinary Tales of the Jewish South, was nominated for a 2006 James Beard Foundation Award. She's co-editor of Jewish Roots and Southern Soil. Her forthcoming work, The Edible South, Food and History in an American Region, examines the expressive power of food from the plantation era to the renaissance of local food economies in the contemporary South. I remember when you were in Columbia and we were at Tree of Life, I think Belinda brought you for your first book. And I bought it because I'm a foodie and I have to tell you, I thoroughly enjoy it. It's wonderful. So I'm excited to hear about your upcoming book. So please join me in welcoming Marcy Cohen Ferris.
Y'all make sure you tell me, can you hear me back there? Everybody hear me? Okay.
Over here.
All right. So good afternoon, campers. All right. So everybody got their hand out?
Yeah.
We're going to start with a sing-along. I'm serious. I'm not going to be the only one singing. So we're going to start with Alan Sherman's famous Hello Mudda, Hello Fada. There's a little intro here. And then we're going to all sing it. I would stop it, but I love all the lyrics. So. Okay, here we go.
Hello, Fada. Hello, Fada. Here I am.
Summer camp was not easy. I felt out of place. I couldn't speak Hebrew. I didn't know the songs. Here's an example. Gebbie Friedman's famous, Not By Might, Not By Power. Some of your kids probably familiar with this.
Not by might and not by
power. Alright, so I didn't know that. Nor could I join in the raucous chanting of the Birkat HaMazon, the traditional Jewish blessing after meals. Let's watch a little bit of that. Play this one. You know, I was homesick. I didn't want to spend the night at camp. I hated corn dogs. And really, to make matters worse, I was 30-something years old, and it was hot as blazes in South Central Mississippi. I was project director of the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience, located at Camp Henry S. Jacobs in Utica, Mississippi. I worked there in the early 1990s. And when I was there, I wondered, who attends summer camp in Mississippi, let alone Jewish summer camp? Hello, it's Mississippi. And my childhood camping experience began in the late 1960s at Camp Wakanda in Rocky Mount, Missouri, on the Lake of the Ozarks. And that was a camp for Jewish youth, but not a Jewish camp. Camp Wakanda was quietly Jew-ish. I borrowed that term from Lisa Collins Cohen, Jew-ish. And imagine, really, a don't ask, don't tell policy regarding our Jewish identity. 200 Jewish kids boating, swimming, and shooting archery, but nobody talked about our Jewishness. It kind of could have been a covert operation with the Jewishness so quiet. To an unsuspecting visitor, Wakanda looked and sounded like any other American summer camp, except for all the Jewish campers and staff. And that was really exactly what Ben Kessler, the founder of Wakanda, wanted when he opened a private Jewish summer camp for boys in 1937. And you'll note that creed there on the bottom. I don't know if you can see it, but it says our camp's creed. He founded the camp with Dorothy Kessler, his wife. Aunt Shotzi was her nickname. I think the Shotzi might have had something to do with a little drinking issue. She was a card, a great skier, driving the ski boat. Their children were world-class skiers. But the camp creed, humility, courtesy, clean living, honor, comradeship, loyalty, fair play. So Ben Kessler began Camp Wakanda in an era of wartime fear and disruption, 37. An anxious time for American Jews, stung by anti-Semitic quotas, discriminations of the interwar years, and the growing horror regarding the fate of European Jewry as the Holocaust came to light in the 1940s. So Kessler hoped to give his campers a summer filled with joy, the opportunity to build strong physiques, improve personal character, although that creed, learn skills, and lastly, to model a democracy as a camp community. So Camp Wakanda was part of the summer camp craze in America that was shaped by what's called the cult of the strenuous life. And that was really an anti-modernist ideology. It sought to repair and to strengthen American society through contact with the great outdoors, and we'll come back to the great outdoors in just a second, as well as it was influenced by the social reform movements of the progressive era in the early 20th century, and these back to nature work projects. Think about all that was going on with the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal. So the first Jewish summer camps were established in the early 1900s, and those were to serve really as pastoral refuge for needy Jewish children in the urban Northeast, and also as sites of Americanization for those children of immigrants. Jewish immigrants who were arriving from Eastern Europe. So during the 1930s, Jewish summer camps and retreat centers with strongly political Jewish political agendas developed. They were sponsored by communists, by socialists, by Zionists, and by Yiddish organizations, and they really grew in popularity in this era. But the majority of those institutions were located largely not in the South, but in the larger Jewish population centers along the East Coast. An example, moving a little closer to our region, the Zionist group Habonim bought a 287-acre farm near Annapolis, Maryland, that became Camp Moshavah. Jewish girls and boys alike learn skills like carpentry and camping, skills that one might learn to live and need to live on a kibbutz in Israel. So kind of really modeling that idea. But during this era, a smaller but an important number of Jewish boarding houses, kosher resorts, and retreat centers were located in the southern mountains. So I'm going to talk about that idea and that kind of concept for just a minute. And then I'll get back to talking about Jewish summer camps. But these resorts and retreat centers, they're kind of the mishpacha of Jewish summer camps. So I want to just talk about them for a second. So although the North Carolina mountains were certainly not like what we think of as the Jewish Catskills, a handful of Jewish boarding houses served southeastern Jewish families in the region, as well as Jewish honeymooners who were coming from Charleston and coming from Savannah. So think about the Southern Mountains as kind of the Borscht Belt Southern style, okay? Hendersonville, North Carolina had Reuben's Osceola Inn on Lake Osceola. In the evenings, there's lots of stories that are collected about these places. Jewish youth dance to big band music and the pavilion on the lake. There's a postcard promoting the beautiful inn on Lake Osceola, and on the reverse of the postcard, the text described the cool and scenic Blue Ridge Mountains. Finest Jewish American cuisine, which I really wonder what that was. Supervised children's program, tennis, golf, heated whirlpool, boating, fishing, pool, entertainment, informal. And so Jewish families from mountain towns, where they were often, of course, the only Jewish family, Jewish merchant in town, came to worship at Hendersonville's Agudas Israel Synagogue, and some stayed at Horowitz's Kosher Inn, where they enjoyed kosher-style meals at the inn. The owner of the inn, the story goes that Abraham Horowitz announced mealtimes with a mountain cowbell. There's another story about Susan Lessing Lewis, who remembered a special pinafore apron that her mother made her for the holidays that she wore to the inn's festive meals, and embroidered across the bib were the words, "Susan Barber wishes you a happy new year." Staring at you. I'm not one of those. So lest one think that modern tourist accommodations for middle-class southern Jewish families were it for Jewishness in the southern mountains, don't forget about Flat Top Manor in Blowing Rock. It was the private summer home of the Cone family of Baltimore, Maryland, and of Greensboro, North Carolina. This magnificent 23-room colonial revival mansion and country estate was built in 1900. That's Bertha Cone there. It overlooked about 3,500 acres of mountain land. It was acquired by this textile magnate of Cone Mills, Moses Cone, his wife Bertha, enjoyed by their cousins. Y'all know who their cousins were, Clarabel and Etta Cone, the great Baltimore art patrons, collectors of Matisse, of Picasso. And the estate, think about this estate, as just one of the many properties that was built by wealthy industrialists in the Gilded Era. What's this?
Biltmore.
By the Vanderbilt. So these were designed as working properties where progressive farming practices, Biltmore too, were modeled. Working dairies, vineyards, cattle operations. But despite the Cones' prominence and their wealth, they were still not welcome in the nearby upper-class mountain resorts such as Asheville's Grove Park Inn, which restricted their patrons to Christian clientele. And this is all well-documented in archival and manuscript material. So in 1949, the National Park Service received ownership of the Cone Estate, of that Flat Top Manor, from the Cone family, which gave the property to the National Park Service. And in the early 1950s, the Colonial Revival Mansion, located aside the Blue Ridge Parkway, became a center for regional crafts. It's managed by the Southern Highland Handicraft Guild. Has anybody been to that? It's just beautiful. But the story, this story that I'm telling you of a Jewish-owned mansion, of fortunes that were built from industry, from textile industry, of wealthy Southerners who lived and dined in the mountains, that really didn't fit in with the National Park Service's narrative about Appalachia, about a rural, pioneer, supposedly isolated world. So this story even when we moved to North Carolina about 12 years ago, and Bill and I stopped at the Craft Center, and I saw the name Cone, of course, on the property, but there was no mention of this history, because it just didn't go with what the National Park Service was interpreting. That is changing now. They have commissioned a research report to more accurately reflect and interpret the Jewish history of Flat Top Manor. I mean, it's just a remarkable place. There are the cousins, Etta and Clarabel Cone. This is a postcard that they'd actually sent to one of their dear friends, Gertrude Stein, the writer, in Italy. So it was quite a remarkable place, the people that came to this world to visit, these Jewish people that came to visit and live and have this lifestyle in the mountains. But you know, even more out of step with the park's invented Appalachian world was the anti-Semitism of these elite white southern resorts, the Jewish atrocities of World War II, whose impact reached even the isolated mountain south. Just one other little story connected to the Cone family. In 1939, Bertha Cone deeded a piece of their Blowing Rock property to her nephew named Norman Lindau, who lived in Boston, and his sisters. The Lindaus were increasingly concerned about the rising wave of anti-Semitism in the world, what they saw as the reluctance of the United States to oppose it, and the Lindau family decided to build a home on this property called Gideon Ridge, and that would be for them a secluded, protected retreat just in case they needed it. So it was there for them in the mountains. It's today now a beautiful inn called Gideon Ridge, and you can go there. It's quite a backstory, though, to the family that one would never see really on the kind of the front side of this inn. It was designed actually by a Boston architect, and the home is built of stone from nearby Grandfather Mountain. That's the view there. It's quite beautiful. And one more institution I want to talk about in the North Carolina mountains, and that is Wild Acres, the summer location of the North Carolina B'nai B'rith Institute. So in 1936, how many folks have been to Wild Acres before? Great. In 1936, I.D. Dick Blumenthal was a successful Jewish businessman, a philanthropist from Charlotte. He heard that a 1,400-acre mountaintop retreat near Little Switzerland in Western Carolina was available from a Texas bankruptcy court. And I.D. and Herman, for those who don't know, their wives, established the Blumenthal Foundation in 1953. They funded Jewish causes, including the circuit riding rabbi program, which sends young rabbis across North Carolina in a bus so you can kind of bring a Sunday school to a community. And the backstory of this property is that the original owner of the property was Thomas Dixon. So Thomas Dixon was the infamous attorney, state legislator, preacher, novelist, real estate speculator, and a movie producer. He was born in Shelby, North Carolina in 1864. And he is known for his Klan trilogy of Southern novels focused on themes of racial purity and the sanctity of the Southern white family. And the most famous of his trilogy, The Klansman, was the basis for D.W. Griffith's controversial but wildly successful Hollywood film, Birth of a Nation. And I know y'all have seen it. It came out in 1950. It was a virulently racist depiction of the Reconstruction era South. It lionized white supremacists. It presented the outcome of social equality for African Americans as misrule and miscegenation. But it was a masterpiece of early cinematography. President Woodrow Wilson praised the film. He screened it in the White House. And the popularity of the film helped to revive the terrorist activities of the Ku Klux Klan. But with the profits from the book and the film royalties, Dixon was able to purchase this mountain retreat, and then he lost Wild Acres after the stock market crash in 1929. So Blumenthal purchased the property and his foundation established Wild Acres as an ecumenical retreat. In an essay on the history of American Jewish camping, historian Jonathan Sarna notes that the availability of property like this, affordable land and real estate in this era, allowed many Jewish institutions and individuals like Mr. Blumenthal to purchase land for camps and retreats. So So you have to wonder about Dixon's reaction to the news of the Jewish buyers of his property and also the prospering Jewish camps that were nearby. Dixon died in 1946, still an unreconstructed son of the Confederacy. So let me take you back to camps now. Non-denominational, private Jewish camps like Camp Wakanda, where I went, grew during the prosperous years after World War II, and they attracted the children of upper, middle-class, well-to-do Jewish families. And so now we're really talking about in the South. Jonathan Sarna connects this model to an era. I mean, he's looking at Jewish camping as different eras, and this era in which Judaism was really reduced to a whisper. Wakanda flew the flag of religious pluralism. So religious pluralism, it's this space, faith, and spiritual consciousness based on this idea of Judeo-Christian values rather than a specific political or denominational expression of Judaism. And this phrase, Judeo-Christian, it came into vogue after World War II. It was really a liberal term for the idea that Western values rest on religious consensus, seen in Brotherhood Day programs, and I remember these, the 1950s that brought together Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish leaders to advance interreligious, interfaith cooperation. So it really should feel like something familiar, probably from your childhoods too. Judeo-Christian became the new national creed as seen in this Interfaith in Action U.S. postage stamp in 1948. So like Ben Kessler of Wakanda, Rabbi Bernard Ehrenreich of the Reformed Congregation Temple Beth Or in Montgomery, Alabama, he also wanted to create a summer camp where Jewish children could improve their mind, their body, and their spirit. He wanted to escape the heat of Alabama, like a sane person would want to do, so he wanted to do this elsewhere. He went first to Maine and later to Wisconsin, where he found an appropriate site for his camp in 1916. But in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. And Rabbi Doc E., who that was his nickname, expressed his camping philosophy in a favorite saying, take the G from great, the O from out, and the D from doors, and the great outdoors can be translated into the name of God, right? So in the South, Jewish education and issues surrounding Jewish identity often received kind of short shrift due to a lack of regional infrastructure, institutional resources, and the small number of Jewish families. And in that sentence, I'm just kind of summing up the Southern Jewish experience, but it's one that you all understand deeply, so I'm not going to go into more detail there, but you all really understand that social situation connected to Jewish education and Jewish resources. So after World War II, really, we see that the social movements of the 1960s and 70s were really inspiring a new Jewish activism, a grassroots activism. It reinforced the Jewish community through regional summer camps and year-round adult education. So it became an era of education that no longer, like those first camps where we were Americanizing the children of immigrants, sending them to these summer camps, this is now an era that's less about Americanization as it is about restoring and rebuilding and reviving Jewishness. So it's really a focus on Jewishness. And in the 1950s, the early 1960s, South Carolina, Jewish children attended local camps sponsored by Jewish communal organizations. And we can really see that in every southern state in Jewish community. Savannah had their JCC camps or their Educational Alliance camps. So in South Carolina, there's Camp Juniper in, Camp Baker in Charleston. And Dale, whose photographs are these?
These are probably from the JCC collection.
Okay, yeah, and all these are from Dale, from the Jewish Heritage Collection. And I think there's about three more photographs here of the JCC camps in Charleston. Anybody see anybody?
that's Nat Schulman over on the right.
Yeah.
Are
they Jewish community
friends? I love that. So these camps were really a cultural island. In an isolated setting, and for some of the camps, you know, the children were separated from home and parents, and summer camp became the perfect setting for really a total immersion in Southern style Judaism. And it really was Southern style. You'll notice the fried chicken, which became the traditional meal at every Southern Jewish camp to have for the Shabbat meal. So Jewish youth and staff and parents alike experienced really a profound sense of belonging at Jewish summer camps across the South, whether it was for 2 weeks or for 2 months. And at these camps, there was a palpable feeling of family and community. Even at Wakanda, where I attended, with its Jewishness, was kind of at a very quiet hum. So campers took their summer experiences of Jewishness, they didn't stay just with them, they took them back home, and really importantly, they helped to revitalize the Jewish world from which they came. So that's a really powerful experience of this, that Jewishness doesn't just remain with kids at camp, but they take it home, and it's transformative for their communities that they're coming from. So raising this kind of Southern Jewish consciousness among campers had long-term consequences too. Here's Macy Hart, who we'll meet tomorrow, but a little bit in the early days. There was an intricate network of Southern Jewish relationships that were created in the summer. Those relationships, as y'all know, and I know there are many examples of this here, it influenced college decisions, future careers, religious involvement. Lots of romances and marriages came out of summer camp. And really, it shaped the next generation of Jewish youth. Many campers and counselors grew into future leaders of the Jewish South's local and regional organizations, historical societies, museums, program for youth, and synagogues. And promoting Jewish education, community, cultural life, and most importantly, this idea of continuity, right? Of Jewish continuity, raising Jewish children committed to their faith and its long-term survival. This was the life work of Southern Jewish camp directors, such as the Popkin family at Camp Blue Star in Hendersonville, North Carolina, which we'll hear about more soon. So honored to meet the Popkins here today. Macy Hart at Camp Henry S. Jacobs in Utica, Mississippi, who began that camp in 1970, Blue Star in 1948. So fundraising materials, we found these for Camp Jacobs in the 1960s when they were trying to raise money, just like Marty and Federica talking about the money and the development required for creating Jewish studies programs. The same kind of money had to come from us, from the community, to create these camps. The concept of a vital, described as the key to the camps as a key to living Judaism. These materials promised to send forth, quote, young Jews proud of their faith and heritage, ready to go to college as committed Jewish youth. I mean, this was how it was so appealing to parents, especially if you were living in a small town in the Jewish South where you felt like your children really didn't have the opportunities of children with larger Jewish populations. So Camp Blue Stars, they had their contemporary living Judaism program that integrates Jewish values, cultures, and traditions that teach as well as uplift. Southern Jewish camps with similar missions, let me just mention a few other, because there are probably at least 10 Jewish camps in the South. Camp Judea in Hendersonville, North Carolina. When you go on its website today, it says a little bit of Israel in the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
That's actually Blue Star.
Yeah. Is that Blue Star?
Yeah.
And Young Judea meeting there?
Yeah.
Right. Camp Ramah Derom, we'll hear more about Camp Ramah Derom from Eric Singer, who's here.
I knew that.
In North Georgia, that was founded in 1996, is that correct? Camp Derom in Wilderville, Tennessee, is a modern Orthodox Zionist camp supported by Baron Hirsch congregation in Memphis. Camp Ramah Derom has a center for Southern Jewry that provides adult and family programs throughout the year for local Jewish families. And I'm sure y'all are familiar, well, I'm not going to talk about Jacobs because I know Macy will go into the really powerful work they're doing in Southern Jewish education and outreach across the region. So I'll talk for just a second about Blue Star, and y'all correct me if I don't have anything right about this. So Camp Blue Star, and who's in the picture?
It's Herman and Rosalind.
Herman and Rosalind. Okay. The oldest family-owned private kosher Jewish camp in the southern United States was founded in 1948 on 740 acres in the western mountains of North Carolina. Of course, 1948, what else happens that year? The founding of the State of Israel. So Jonathan Sarna, historian, describes this era as really the crucial decade in Jewish camping. It's an era in which Jewish education was both an expression of cultural resistance after the Holocaust and an American promise. So those two things, an American promise to build and uphold the Jewish people. So brothers Herman, Harry, and Ben Popkin were active in Atlanta Zionist and B'nai B'rith youth organizations. After they returned from World War II, they helped to build a Jewish camp in the South. And I mean, look at these people. They all look like superhuman. You know, all this staff and just are incredible. So while conducting research for this business venture, the Popkins spoke with owners of non-Jewish camps in North Georgia. They spoke with a woman named Jane McConnell of Camp Cherokee. And this is from the... What's the name of the memoir of the camp?
Herman's memoir?
Yes. I can't remember.
Give me a week already, right?
But the memoir of Blue Star, so I'm quoting from that. You boys, she said, you boys ought to do it. Once Upon a Summer. Herman Popkins' memoir of Blue Star. You boys ought to do it. There's a need for a camp like the one you propose, especially for older children. Most private camps down south won't accept Jewish children. And those that do so on a strict quota basis, which was certainly within keeping what was happening with graduate programs across the South at our public university. It was happening at Chapel Hill. It was happening at summer camps. Eli Evans, who couldn't be with us this weekend, but he was a former Blue Star camper. He wrote about Blue Star in his classic memoir of the Southern Jewish life, The Provincials. And he said, Herman and Harry Popkin, they built a veritable camping empire in the post-war era. And it was a Southern Jewish mountain paradise for young boys like Eli Evans. You know, you know that world. Imagine a magical world of bonfires, of hiking, of Israeli folk dancing taught by actual Israelis, Jewish girls, deep discussions about God and Jewish identity. And Eli writes it, for the rest of our days, it seemed, one sure way that Jewish kids all over the South could start a long conversation was by asking, what years were you at Blue Star? Is that your, these are your great
photos. Yeah, that's my picture.
I know, they're such wonderful photographs. So, and I'll, can you read what you wrote on the back?
Yes, there's two crazies, two of the funniest boys I know. And I mean funny, Randy Feinberg and Sonny Evans, Regional Convention Blues. That was a convention, Blue Star,
right.
In 1952.
1952. So here's Eli, right? And
we called him
Sonny, right?
It was Sonny. We didn't know him as Sonny.
I love that.
Oh, my God.
I've heard Eli speak many times. Eli Evans speak many too, and he would about the young girls from Charleston. He would always say, "Those Charleston girls."
There we are, Miss Sandy.
There you are,
Miss Sharon.
It's really fantastic.
Nancy Evans.
So their Jewish education, the Jewish methodology, differed. Camp Blue Star had this commitment to Jewish education that was front and center in their daily programming. While Wakanda's Jewish ideology was expressed in concepts like values rather than overt curriculum. But the two camps were really joined by their founders' commitment to providing the highest quality private camping experience for Jewish children. I wanted just to throw in for Roger and Candy a picture I took of Naomi and Harry Popkin when I interviewed them for Matzah Ball Gumbo many years ago. That was back in 2001. I had an appointment with them, came to their lovely apartment about 8 o'clock in the morning, and they look like that. You know, I was like, have you ever never stopped looking like camp directors? They were like in all white, you know, or kind of all white. Just so powerful. Rod, you know, Rod's great, just incredible. I mean, there's a special breed of people who are Jewish camp directors.
It's an affliction. I don't think it's a breed.
No, Dale and I were saying they're like rabbis. They're pretty much, they're a little higher than rabbis in the Jewish South, we think. Yeah. So Wakanda's founder, Ben Kessler, we called him Uncle Benny. He was born in 1903. He came from a family of 10 that included his four brothers and three sisters. His Eastern European parents, Jenny and Jacob Kessler, worked in the fruit and produce business in St. Louis. They lived in a working-class neighborhood called Carey Patch, named for the many Irish Catholic families who lived there. And according to their nephew, Dr. Tom Loeb, the Kessler brothers were all big guys and fine athletes. They were award-winning boxers and football players in high school. And Ben Kessler refereed fights, including one with boxer Rocky Graziano. Ben's brother, Harry Kessler, was known as the millionaire referee. He worked in the ring with boxing champions Joe Louis, Jack Dempsey, and Cassius Clay, a.k.a. Muhammad Ali. And he brought that passion for athletics, coaching, boxing, community recreation. Camping was a natural profession for Ben Kessler. His first boys camp in Missouri closed when Kessler joined the armed forces during World War II. And then in 1945, he reopened the camp in a spacious peninsula on the Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri, a lake created in the early 1930s after the damming of the Osage River with the construction of Bagnell Dam. That dam provided, as much of this kind of work across the South was happening at this era, the dam provided electric power for the region, and equally important, thousands of jobs soon after the Depression began. And the name that Ben Kessler chose for his camp, Wakanda, referred to the great spirit of the Omaha tribes, who were related to the Sioux. So here's the question, you know, why does a nice Jewish man choose an Indian name, right, for his Jewish camp? Well, early leaders in Jewish camping adopted the same American Indian folklore, a fascination with Indian folklore, heritage, language that had so deeply influenced American camping at the turn of the 20th century. And, you know, all these Jewish camps took on all these Indian names. There's a zillion of them. And Jewish comedians often speculate whether Native Americans have given Jewish names like Camp Whitefish and Camp Kreplach to their summer camps. Camp Schlemiel, all these Jewish names. But this phenomenon, a folklorist and historian, Raymond Green, who is at the Smithsonian, has written about this phenomenon, this kind of concept, argues that one of the oldest and most pervasive forms of American cultural expression is the performance of playing Indian. And it really, we can see this in American popular culture. It begins really with stories of Pocahontas saving Captain John Smith, historical versions, there's the Disney version of it, the first Thanksgiving, that story, Squanto saving the Pilgrims, there's Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's Hiawatha in 1855. It helped to solidify the image of the Indian, this kind of very romanticized image of the Indian in the American imagination. Victorian era societies like the Elks, the Lions, the Kiwanis introduced this idea of playing Indian to the white middle class. This is really tied to the Boy Scouts, also founded in 1908. This was yet another expression of this playing Indian. Indians really represented this scouting ideal, particularly of manly independence, a masculinity. These themes were perpetuated in summer camps, and Jewish camps embraced also this celebration of Native American culture. So a little bit more about Wakanda. In these photographs, the black and whites of Wakanda are from Stephen Rich, who is a dear friend of ours in Chapel Hill, who attended camp in the 1950s and sent his beautiful scrap album that he kept of his camp photographs to Dale to include in the
archives.
Yeah, in the archives. So there were weekly boxing matches at Camp Wakanda, weekly boxing matches because of Kessler's interest in making these strong, healthy,
young men after World War II, Jewish young men who could defend themselves. I mean, think about these themes of pumping them up, of building them to be strong young men and then women. If you didn't box at camp, you played tennis, you learned to water ski, whether you wanted to or not. You were an expert marksman. You might be an intrepid canoer. So sportsmanship and athleticism, again, they were celebrated during, especially during the last week of camp. Color wars, everybody remember color wars? Color wars, a world, the camp I went to, a world of red and black, divided the camp into two teams. You fought to end endless baseball games, swimming competitions, and one-legged sack races across the athletic field. I thought camp color wars would never end. So Ben Kessler was really in the business of building strong Southern youth, Jewish youth. And but he did not really focus so much on Jewish identity. He was more spiritual than religious. When camp ended after 8 weeks, we were really sturdy pioneers, but not the kibbutz kind of pioneers. At Wakanda, our focus was really less on Israel and more on the American frontier. Even the Wakanda Summer Bulletin from 1950 was entitled The Wakanda Pioneer. So Ben Kessler was a child of immigrant parents. He was a veteran of World War II. He witnessed the tragic losses of the Holocaust. And he created a summer world where Jewish children would learn confidence, teamwork, respect for God, and also how to throw a good punch. And, you know, no one ever forgot Ben Kessler's motto that hung from a crossbeam in the dining lodge. God first, you second, me third. That was the mantra at camp. It was repeated again and again and again. But there were no Friday evening Shabbat services at Wakanda back in my era. So, you know, you think about how that's just the centerpiece of Blue Star, of Henry Jacobs, of many Southern Jewish camps today. Shabbat is the centerpiece of the week. That didn't happen. Instead, we gathered at Inspiration Point each Sunday morning, everybody still dressed in starched whites, for a sermon from Uncle Benny, who was a master storyteller. He wove Indian tales with lessons about team spirit, loyalty, kindness, and respect for nature. And I vividly remember his story about the power of community and family. He would pick up a small stick on the ground. He could easily break that little stick into two. He then took the broken pieces, added a few more, and holding all these together, tried unsuccessfully to break them. You know, we got the message. So Sunday services were followed by, food was very important, a noontime meal, again, of Southern fried chicken, mashed potatoes, peas, and red jello. George Buckner of Boonville, Missouri, an African-American chef, ran the kitchen at Wakanda for over 30 years. Many African-Americans ran these, and still do, ran Jewish summer camp food services. Here is Johnny Glorioso. I love this guy. Many of the counselors and staff at Wakanda were not Jewish. Kessler hired talented young men and women from colleges and universities across the nation. When I looked up Johnny Glorioso in one of the Wakanda summer albums, his address is listed as the Phi Delta Theta House at Columbia, Missouri. So there he was at the University of Missouri. And he was emphasizing, again, excellence. Many of his administrative staff worked, and non-Jewish staff, worked as St. Louis area school principals and teachers during the winter months. For Wakanda, campers came from Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, Kansas City, Little Rock, Memphis, Oklahoma City, Omaha, St. Louis, Tulsa, small town throughout the South. Stephen Rich remembers how he took the overnight train from Atlanta to St. Louis with his Jewish buddies and their excitement about staying in those overnight sleeping compartments. And here I am getting on a little plane to fly to camp. Remember before the days when you could walk out to the airplane? Once you arrived at camp, Ben Kessler, like all these famous camp directors, would greet every camper with a hug and a quick verbal ID. Hello, Marcy Cohen of 440 Rosemary Lane in Blytheville, Arkansas. And that mental exercise was a dazzling demonstration of a camp director's unique skills, but also made you feel a little safe, like you knew where you lived. So the days and the weeks at Wakanda were filled with nonstop summer rituals and traditions and song sessions and wildly creative programs, as we still see at camp, devised by staff. Monday night was square dancing. Wednesday night was a special event. Thursday night was cabin night. Saturday night was a boy-girl social. Sunday was reserved for non-sectarian morning services and the weekly Council Fire Awards. I think there's my award for square dancing. And then here's another one, commenting on my behavior or something like that. But the most dramatic moment of the summer was Tomahawk Night. So again, what good Jewish camp doesn't have a Tomahawk Night? In the middle of the night, campers were awakened, led to the ball field by counselors in politically incorrect Indian garb. Carrying lit torches, we stood in a large circle as the Indians chose some senior campers judged to be the most outstanding and pushed them into the center of our gathering. After being inducted into the Tomahawk Club in a secret ceremony, the special campers slept on the ball field overnight. They were not allowed to speak to anyone for 24 hours. Each received a sacred tomahawk. So I don't know what camps are doing now if they're not doing Indian stuff anymore. So, because this just shaped everything that we did. In the morning, the Tomahawk Club recipients were announced to the entire camp. It was high drama. I don't think I've experienced that kind of drama since. So Camp Wakanda closed in 1969. There was actually a terrible car accident that a camper was involved in and a death. It was the first fatality in the camp's history. It devastated Ben Kessler and the camp community. And when I was a young camper there, I think that death of the young woman felt like the end of our innocence, and I think it really was. This was the same summer as Woodstock. The song Aquarius had just won a Grammy for Record of the Year. It was the same year that Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon. College students had taken over the administration building at Harvard. The American death toll in Vietnam had rose to over 40,000. So the recession of the 1970s, coupled with rising taxes, expenses, increased accreditation, regulatory bureaucracy and procedures, these were really challenging times for camp directors, camp owners like Ben Kessler, especially when insurance rates were skyrocketing. The Jewish Community Center of St. Louis acquired Wakanda in 1969 after a group of Jewish benefactors purchased the facility, and they renamed it Camp Sabra. And they donated the camp to the community in 1970. So my sister and I returned for Sabra's charter year. It looked the same, but something was terribly awry. Uncle Benny was gone. The counselors in crisp white shorts were no more. My friends had vanished to camps in Minnesota and Wisconsin. I remember that first summer my sister went on a week-long canoe trip where the counselors in charge lost a few campers to my parents' horror, but they found them after a day or two. But I remember that Jamie was kind of gone for a while. And most of all, the biggest thing that happened, the camp was suddenly Jewish. Jewish, really Jewish. So cabin names changed from those Indian names from Osage and Kickapoo to Habonim and Golan. Israeli youth led dance workshops and song sessions. Shabbat replaced Sunday. No more Sunday. It was just a regular day at camp. And there were no more lunchtime pizza burgers. It was a startling introduction of kosher dietary laws in which meat and milk never met on a bun again. And, you know, we enjoyed our summer at Sabra, but eventually my sister and I followed our Wakanda friends north to Camp Thunderbird, another quietly Jewish camp in Bemidji, Minnesota, that had that familiar mix of Jewish campers, of Native American culture, and challenging program we had known at Wakanda. So when I was preparing this essay, I interviewed many Camp Wakanda alumni, and each described their experience, their camping experience, as life-changing, as really a transformative experience. These campers were part of a generation of American Jews who were literally transformed as Jonathan Sarna explains, by the spell of these camps. And from these campers, again, came future Jewish community leaders, rabbis, and scholars. Ben Kessler and his staff at Wakanda, the Popkins and their staff at Blue Star, created this educational experience summer after summer after summer. Mike Kessler, who is a son of Ben Kessler's brother Saul, was a camper and a counselor for many years, and he said of his uncle, there was no way if you were involved with him not to see his heart for young people. And I think that's a similar feeling that we see with other leaders of Jewish summer camps in the South. Uncle Ben was a righteous man. There was a way to get things done, and that was the righteous way. He taught what it meant to live an honorable life. Merrill Bauman Stern of Little Rock, Arkansas, said of Wakanda, "I felt like I had come home." And it really did feel like home. Actually, for a lot of kids, more than home felt like home, you know, to be at Jewish summer camp. So without explicit Jewishness at Wakanda, its quiet Jewishness created a place where we could be Jewish Southerners for once and not feel like outsiders. And we really were insiders, members of a magical world that was impossible to describe to my non-Jewish friends back home. My mother would always warn when I came home from camp, she'd say, "Don't go on and on about camp. It's not polite to brag." So I never would talk about it, and people really didn't understand what I was talking about anyway. But, you know, camp would end. I'll show you one little picture of me looking forlorn at camp back in the day. We would put away our material, all our camp goods and clothing and trunks in the attic until the next summer, and my sister Jamie and I would be back home. And again, we were the Cohen girls in our own little cultural island in Arkansas, very separated from these quietly Jewish worlds that we were privileged to experience at Wakanda back in the 1970s. I only wish I had been able to go to Blue Star. You know, I ended up as I kind of began the talk, in my 30s. You know, at Henry S. Jacobs, where I worked on the Institute for Southern Jewish Life. So that really was my first real introduction to real Jewish camp, and it was a phenomenal experience. And I really wish that I had had that experience too as a young woman. So I'm going to stop there. Hopefully that kind of gives you a little bit of a sense of kind of the social history and kind of the cultural context of how these camps developed. I know that in the article that I wrote and in the other articles that essays that Dale has included in the South Carolina Jewish Historical Society newsletter, there's good bibliographies for lots of materials about Jewish camping in America. And a lot of great material has been written. So if you're interested in this field, there's lots to read. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Marcy. That was wonderful. You really laid the groundwork for us. We have a few minutes. Anybody have any questions, comments before we take a break?
Or pictures they see? Yeah.
I'm curious about something. Watching this for me was phenomenal because I didn't go to one of those camps, and it makes me wish I had. Of course, I wished I had even then. But I
Where did you grow up?
Portsmouth, Virginia.
Okay, great.
You had one picture up there. Was Soft. It was a Temple youth group, and I went 2 years in a row to a place called Camp White Mountain, which was just inside the West Virginia border. And it was an LTI leadership training institute. It was called for USY, out of the Vascular Conservative Movement. I'm wondering if you have done anything on, or people have done anything about the impact of those 1 week, because I felt like it had a profound impact on me. And it was just 1 week, two times in my life.
Right. I'd love for anybody else have that experience of attending, you know, 1 week, weekends.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. You know, I've only wrote kind of a short piece on this. But yeah, no, I think those kind of experiences, and you know, they were really transformative. You took what you can get, you know, and for a lot of kids in the Jewish South, what was available was that short-term experience, and that was amazing. to come back to that. Yeah, Sandra.
Marcy, in all your research, did you run into Brandeis? Brandeis had a camp in North Carolina in the early 50s that I know my husband spent some time at, and it was transformative for him.
Right, right. What did you do?
Well, I was going to mention that the Brandeis Bardeen Institutes, one in Pennsylvania, one in California, and one in Hendersonville, that was actually where my father had gone. And he was inspired by Bardeen to try to create a modern Jewish person in a post-Holocaust world. And yes, Bardeen is a controversial figure because he sold his camps in North Carolina and in Pennsylvania after having gotten the benefactors to deed the land to him, and he built a much larger camp in California, which is still out there. But he may in fact have been the godfather of all of those kinds of movements. And certainly, I know about it because my dad used to talk about it all the time. So,
I have a quick question.
That's a really important question.
Say who your dad was.
Oh, my dad was the author of Once Upon a Summer.
Herman Popkin, one of the three Popkin brothers that founded Blue Star.
It was big.
Yeah, that's a really important fact.
And he didn't get a lot of attention. Partially because I think he was seen as a very self-serving kind of character.
Yeah.
But that was only a part of his.
Yeah, I was telling Roger, there's definitely a master's or thesis or a PhD.
Somebody's.
Their dissertation writing about Jewish summer camps. There's so much research to be done. And just before people go on, the camping materials, and I know Dale must be collecting these materials for the Jewish Heritage Collection at the College of Charleston. If you have ephemera and material, scrap albums, photographs, awards, certificates, those all need to go into the collection. Those are really important materials like these photographs.
Did you ever come across a camp called Tell Me More?
Yeah, I have heard it. Tell us more.
I just wondered if you did.
I've heard of it.
It was a Zionist camp up in New Jersey.
Yeah, right, right. What was it, though, in New Jersey?
I forgot. I think it was I went there. I think it was New Hampshire or something.
New Hampshire, okay. Young Judea movement.
Yeah, it's a Young Judea
movement.
Yeah, that camp is not part of the Young Judea, but it kind of ran the same. A lot of people in Columbia actually went to that camp.
Tell you who to only took older kids.
Yeah, it was a senior camp.
But Robert was saying to me too, you know, there were these kind of regional distribution patterns of where Jewish kids went to camp, depending on where you grew up in the South, right?
I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. So that all needs to be charted. It's really fascinating. Well, the kids that ended up in, like, you know, in Maine, you know, a lot of New Orleans Jewish people I know went to camp in Maine.
And some of them went to the upper Midwest.
Upper Midwest.
It just depends on what they were looking for. You know, I'm not going to steal your time.
You're the expert.
I'm hardly an expert, but in terms of what he was talking about, the LTI at White Pine, there was one at Blue Star also. They always had them before they had Ramaz regionally. But I think that the hard part of trying to figure that value out is that they were usually a part of a year-round program, that USY would function all year long, and then they had the LTIs at the one-week location. So in a way, it's like preaching to the already converted. You just gave them a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week process. I'm sure Eric Singer tomorrow will talk about the LTI evolution into Ramon de Rome, because that's basically where it all came from. But there always had those, and so did Judeas, and so did the Reform movements, and the Judeas were a little more complicated because they were Zionists. They weren't particularly religious. In the last 15 years, there's been a lot of integration of the idea of what being a Jewish camp actually is. So it's really hard to be definitive. Well, it isn't hard to be opinionated.
That's great.
anybody else have something to add?
I just wanted to say I want to thank you. You've explained to me Capo Scola when I was 10, 42.
Yeah, the name, yeah.
No, but the whole experience.
The whole experience.
Of being 10,
yeah.
A terrible experience of a month.
A whole month.
I was there.
At Camp Osceola. Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break. There are refreshments in the lobby.
I see lots of materials.
We'll start back in